country, as long as it's not violent or interrupt somebody else's freedom. All right, with that being said, I'm going to come to a close. Y'all have a blessed and safe Sunday. I'm out of here.
I wish I could say all the things that I should say. Say them loud, say them clear for the whole round world to hear.
Greetings, I'm Chuck Foster. Join me at 2 p.m. Sundays for Reggae Central, playing ska, rock steady, roots, dub, and dancehall. New releases, old favorites, and delightful obscurities right here on KPFK 90.7 FM in L.A.
Hi, this is Elliot Gould, and you're listening to KPFK, 90.7 FM in Los Angeles, and 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara.
Welcome to Beneath the Surface. I'm Susie Wiseman. Today, journalist and author John Dinges joins us to discuss his gripping new book, I have to say, Chile in Their Hearts, The Untold Story of Two Americans Who Went Missing After the Coup. John Dinges lived in Chile during the popular unity government of Salvador Allende and also in the years following the terror and the coup of 1973. The book reopens the haunting case of Charlie Horman, or Charles Horman, and Frank Teruggi, two young Americans who came to experience and support Chile's experiment of a democratic and peaceful transition to socialism under President Salvador Allende. They were each separately detained, went missing, and executed in the days following the military takeover. The story was immortalized in the Oscar-winning film Missing, which depicted Horman as the man who knew too much about U.S. involvement in the coup. But Chile in Their Hearts challenges that version and uncovers the sham investigation and cover-up behind its false conclusions. We're going to speak with John Dinges about what really happened, what's newly revealed through declassified documents, eyewitness testimony, and his meticulous, thorough investigation of the evidence, and we'll ask why this story still matters today. That's when our program returns in just a moment. Welcome back to Beneath the Surface. I'm Susie Wiseman, speaking with journalist John Dinges, whose new book, Chile in Their Hearts, re-examines the lives and deaths of Charles Horman and Frank Teruggi, and what their fate tells us about whether the U.S. was complicit or just supportive of the coup, and what it tells us about justice and international solidarity. Chile was a touchstone for radicalized youth around the world in the early 70s, just as an earlier generation had been by the Spanish Civil War in the 1930s. Those who could flocked to Chile to be part of the Popular Unity's government experiment in radical democracy led by Salvador Allende, because it posited a peaceful transition to socialism a la chilena, with vino tinto and empanadas, red wine and empanadas, using the ballot box and constitutional means to achieve profound social, economic, and political transformations that working people demand. The September 11th, 1973 coup destroyed 150 years of Chilean democracy and the dream of a better Chile. It also ignited an international solidarity movement, much as the Spanish Civil War did in the 30s, as people were horrified by the brutality of the Chilean junta under Augusto Pinochet, who vowed to rid Chile of the Marxist cancer and proceeded to detain, torture, execute, and disappear supporters of Allende and activists, including the Americans Charlie Horman and Frank Tarucci. Well, John Dinges lived there in Chile from 1972 through 1978, and he was reporting from there as well. He was a special correspondent for the Washington Post, and he was later a managing editor at NPR. And he's now professor emeritus of journalism at Columbia University and the author of many books, including not just this one, but The Condor Years, How Pinochet and His Allies Brought Terrorism to Three Continents, Assassination on Embassy Row, and other books as well. And this new one, of course, Chile in Their Hearts. I want to say that John's going to be speaking about this book later this afternoon at La Peña at 6 o'clock in Berkeley. And he'll be in Los Angeles at Diesel Books on May 27th. And I'll be talking to him. John, with all of that, thanks and welcome to the program.
Well, thanks a lot for inviting me. This is really great to be on.
Thank you. And it's really good to hear you say that. I have to say, of course, that, and I mentioned to you earlier, it was an emotional experience reading this great book. And I hope that the listeners, after listening to this, will want to do the same thing. But let's just get started. And let me ask you very first to describe or summarize the official version of the Horman and Tarucci cases that your book dismantles.
It's a kind of circular confirmation of ideas that started out as assumptions that most of us all held at the time, that the U.S. was responsible for the coup, and the family reasonably suspected, with very good reason, that the U.S. might have been involved in fingering Charles Horman, and then eventually even they might have been involved in Frank Tarucci's death. The official version was enshrined in the movie Missing. The movie Missing was based on a book by Thomas Hauser. Thomas Hauser based his book on his interviews with Ed Horman, Charlie's father. And Ed Horman based his view of what happened on a witness named Rafael Gonzalez, an intelligence officer who claimed that he had seen Charles in custody, and he claimed he saw a CIA man together with them when they decided to execute Charles. Well, that falls apart when Rafael Gonzalez, the key witness, says he made it all up. He took 25 years before he admitted that, but he submitted an affidavit to the Chilean court in 2003. He had actually written it 2 years before, saying that for various reasons that he explains and I explain in the book, that it was a fabrication. It was absolutely false. Those are his words. There was no CIA agent there. He does maintain that he did see Horman. So when he spoke out in an interview with a Washington Post journalist, Joanne Omang, and said that Charles Horman was killed because he knew too much, that seemed to confirm to the family what they already suspected, that Charles was killed because of some information he got about the coup in Valparaiso, where he was stuck in the days immediately following the coup. So it's a circular verification, which I dismantled. It's a fascinating story of disinformation, of somebody making something up to save himself, because he too was a defector and he was trying to get out of Chile. Eventually he comes clean and says it was an invention.
Thank you for all of that, and also previewing what Missing got wrong and how Missing got it wrong. But Missing, of course, had a gigantic impact, and I think it was a positive one in the world because it highlighted what really happened. And I have to say that in my own case, it was really amazing because my own father could have been Ed Horman. He was a businessman. He was sort of a liberal Republican. And right. When he met his new son-in-law, who told him, that was my husband at the time, that what had happened to him in the stadium and why he was a refugee and how he ended up like that, my father was, of course, affected by it, but I think a little suspicious. But when he saw Missing, He identified with Ed Horman, changed his view. And I remember saying to Roberto, my husband, promise me you will never go back to that country, a country that treated you so poorly. And I think that that is just one example of what, you know, certainly many people did not have a direct tie to Chile. But I think that the film itself, wrong as it was in its conclusions, had just a tremendous impact.
I totally share that view. The movie was the most important film about what happened in Chile. It gets it right in depicting the terror of the time, in depicting the bloodiness and the violence, the arbitrariness, the mass killing, what happened in the stadium. All of those things are absolutely true. Of course, the central story is dramatic, and it depends on the evolution of Ed Horman, the father, who comes to Chile thinking, well, of course, the U.S. Embassy is going to help me. And instead of helping him, they deceive him. And when he realizes that they deceive him, he suspects, and we would have too, that they are hiding something. It's a Hollywood movie. But as I point out in the book, perhaps the irony is that the art of the movie had so much influence in actually determining people's view of the actual facts. Yeah. To the extent that it's the movie's scenario that determines the verdict of a Chilean court case that was issued in 2016. And it was at that time that I actually decided to write the book.
Wow. Well, before we get there, I'd like you to tell just our listeners a little bit about who Charlie Horman and Frank Tarugi were and what drew them to Chile, along with so many other Europeans, intellectuals, journalists, students, activists, and as you say, left-wing exiles from other dictatorships in Latin America in the first place. And then maybe talk about their involvement.
Well, Chile was a mecca for political activists and exiles from all over the world. I estimate there were about 20,000 foreigners in Chile at the time that I was there, 300 perhaps Americans. I'm talking just about the progressives. I'm not talking about the CIA sympathizers, right, who were also there, but there weren't very many of them. The Americans came because they had come out of the civil rights movement, the anti-war movement, perhaps are disillusioned. Those of us who lived through that, we were disillusioned when Nixon was elected in 1968. And those of us who spoke Spanish, we decided we would go south. Allende's experiment was a model for the rest of Latin America. And of course, that's what made Henry Kissinger so determined to obliterate it. The other foreigners in Chile were largely exiles from the other dictatorships or authoritarian governments that had already emerged in Latin America with U.S. support. And so many of them, and many of the Americans, continued their political activism. They aligned with certain parties. Some of them took jobs in the Allende government. It was easy to get a visa. I was working as a journalist. There were many other people who were filing for various publications. And I had to say, it was a hell of a lot of fun. We were enthusiastic, effervescent, full of energy, and the Chileans were very welcoming, although occasionally they would accuse us being agents of the CIA almost automatically because we're Americans.
Right? Yeah.
You know, I'm sure you've heard that. And we just kind of, okay, yeah, no, I'm not. I understand why you think that, because my government, we know, is trying to overthrow the government of Chile. But that didn't really matter. They let us participate anyway. Charles Horman and Frank Tarugi, by the way, Tarugi is the correct pronunciation, they were both activists. Frank, more than Charlie, Frank had come out of a liberation theology, a Catholic education. He transitioned from liberation theology to Marxism, to become a student of Marxism, a not unusual evolution. And Charlie was a journalist. He had worked on the West Coast for a couple of years in documentary film, came back to New York, had a job in a conservative business magazine for a while. You see the picture of him in his thin tie and his suit and his short hair, and you can see the evolution that he is undergoing. He and his wife embark on this wonderful adventure in a Chevy truck with a camper built in the back, and they want to go to South America.
Welcome to Beneath the Surface. I'm Susie Wiseman. Today we're going to talk to David Ost. He's an expert on Poland, and we're going to be talking about the stunning results of Poland's June 1st presidential election. The race was tight, but in the end, the far-right candidate, Karol Nawrocki, narrowly defeated Warsaw's liberal mayor, Rafał Trzaskowski, 50.89% to 49.1%. This wasn't just a Polish story. Sent a signal across Europe and the world. After recent electoral defeats for Trumpist candidates in Canada, Australia, and Romania, it seemed that maybe there was an international anti-Trump bump underway. But Polish voters, just 2 years after electing Donald Tusk, have once again swung right. Nawrocki, a far-right historian and former boxer, defeated Trzaskowski, who was backed by Prime Minister Donald Tusk. Populism is shown to have staying power, and center-left liberal governance has failed to offer a durable counter. But is that the whole story? David Ost argues that Tusk in power promised a program of radical changes, but delivered too little, dampening enthusiasm and turnout, not unlike what happened to Biden and Harris. He also argues that the liberal left campaigned on Nawrocki's negative personal qualities, including his tough working class background, but not on the reactionary, xenophobic, racist, and sexist policies he promotes. We'll unpack the meaning of this election, explore its implications for Poland, Europe, and for the global authoritarian populist right. All that coming up when our program returns in just a moment. And welcome back to Beneath the Surface. I'm Susie Wiseman. Political theorist David Ost is joining us today with his observations and analysis of Poland's recent stunning presidential election. Just 2 years after liberal leader Donald Tusk came to power, Polish voters have swung back to the right, narrowly electing Karol Nawrocki, a hardline nationalist with MAGA-style politics, and Trump's endorsement. We'll get his take on what this election reveals about the continuing attraction of the authoritarian nationalist populist right to working class voters and the failures of the centrist liberals to offer a convincing alternative. We'll also ask why the Tusk coalition failed to deliver on their democratic reforms, how class resentment and strategic missteps helped the far right, and why Polish workers continue to vote against the left liberal parties. Is Poland a warning to democratic left centrists everywhere? And what does this mean for Europe and for the world? Well, that's an awful lot to unpack. And I'm really happy to have David Ost back with us again. He is an emeritus professor at Hobart and William Smith Colleges. He's written widely on Eastern Europe, particularly Poland, with a focus on labor, class, democracy, and the new right. His books include Solidarity in the Politics of Anti-Politics, Workers After Worker States, and The Defeat of Solidarity. And I think we've talked about two out of those three right here on this program. And he's also edited a collection called Class After Communism. His articles have appeared in Jacobin, The Nation, Dissent, and Telos. Recent articles include Why Workers Often Oppose Democracy, Workers in the Radical Right in Poland, and the surprising right-wing relevance of the Russian Revolution. He's currently completing a book titled Red Pill Politics, Right-Wing Populism from Fascism to Today. And as soon as that book comes out, I guarantee you, David, we will have you back to talk about it. And I hope that today we'll touch on some of that because it certainly has relevance to this right-wing surge. So with all of that, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you so much for the invitation and the kind introduction.
Well, let's just get started, I guess, with the basics. Who is Nawrocki? What happened? As I said in the intro, he won by a razor-thin margin. So what really happened that you found most surprising and revealing, and what does it tell us about where Poland is headed?
Well, okay, let's see if I can begin to unpack some of these things. Now, Vrotsky was someone who was completely unknown to the wider electorate until about 6 months ago, when Law and Justice Party, that's the name of the right-wing party that he's from, and its leader, Jaroslaw Kaczynski, picked Navrotsky to run for president. He was not formally a member of the party, but he's been closely associated with the Law and Justice Party for quite a long time. He had been head of the Institute of National Remembrance. This is an institute that controls all the historical archives in Poland and has been a centerpiece, a kind of home for far-right historians and cultural warriors who want to resuscitate the image of far-right fascists from the interwar period and others. A very skewed interpretation of history. Because peace, I will use the word peace a lot. It doesn't mean peace like we mean it. It's the Polish initials for the Law and Justice Party. So peace has been in the forefront of pushing what it calls historical politics or historical policy, where they clearly see that teaching a very skewed Polish history in which all
tonight at 10 p.m.
all leftists are traitors, that's the obligation to teach their students. In any case, this is the man who Kaczynski chose 6 months ago. But as everyone knew, this election was basically, some say, a referendum between the Law and Justice Party and the Liberal Party, the civic platform led by Donald Tusk. But that Liberal Party has been in coalition with some moderate Christians and also with the left. The former Communist Party, long since a liberal pro-capitalist, pro-market party, but somewhat social protectionist, and a more what we might call a new left party, a kind of Bernie Sanders-like party, really. As you
wait, can you just go back for 1 second? Because is this party part of the coalition or is it just another party on the
spectrum? Okay, that's interesting. We want to get into that because actually about 6 months ago, it split with some of them being part of the coalition and some of them saying we won't support it at all. So in any case, when I said this is really a kind of vote between these two main parties, it means that the real question in these elections was still a kind of referendum about the years between 2015 and 2023 when the Law and Justice Party governed Poland. I guess it's fair to say that there were two different referendums, in a sense, is what made it complicated, because some people were still thinking about 2015 to 23. And then others were thinking about 2023 to today. So for your listeners, I have to explain that Poland has a very unusual kind of half presidential, half parliamentary system.
Like France or different?
Kind of like France, but the president does not have the same power as in France, has less power, but some power. So in other words, like in France, there are separate elections for president, separate elections for parliament. When peace was in power from 2015 to 23, it had both the parliament and the presidency. So anything that peace passed, the president, their president would sign. In 2023, there were parliamentary elections. That's when Donald Tusk returned at becoming prime minister as head of a large coalition.
And is this coalition called?
Oh, they call it the Coalition of October 15th, because that's when they won the election. In 2023, in October, when the coalition won parliamentary elections, Tusk became prime minister, but they still had a peace president. And so in many ways, the coalition in power now has not fully been able to implement its laws because they knew that the president would veto them.
So that was going to be my next question. So let me just state it. The Tusk government was hailed as a model for democratic recovery in some ways from the Law and Justice Party. But you're saying that this is a shallow restoration in a way. And so I guess the question that it seems you're moving into is why liberalism in this regard faltered and why the promises that they made went unfulfilled. And I think if I'm hearing you right, it's because of the obstacles in the system and in the structure of the system, partially.
Right. Well, this is the question that many people are trying to figure out now, because clearly the strategy, the hope of this coalition, that let's not do much because we can't succeed anyway, let's wait for a president who would sign our bills. And so for many people, it was a question simply that the coalition couldn't realize their big dreams, ambitions of changing the laws, including things like providing for legal civic partnerships, which they don't have in Poland. Of course, there's strong opposition to gay marriage. Those who were calling for some kind of equality have called for civic partnership, but there's still no law on that. Also, one of the strong issues in 2023 that brought many young people and young women into the coalition was to fight against the draconian abortion restrictions that Kaczynski and his Supreme Court, which he also took over during that time, had ruled that it really made abortion impossible in almost all circumstances.
Was that very unpopular, by the way? You know, that one question of abortion, I didn't mean to interrupt, Red, but it seems like, you know, I remember this very clearly when Poland was part of the so-called Soviet bloc and abortion was liberal everywhere, but Poland was different because it was so Catholic. People thought it would be hard to get rid of the free and liberal abortion almost on demand everywhere. What was the case in Poland?
Well, in Poland, during the communist period, you're right, even despite the influence of the church, the right to abortion was never an issue. I remember being in Poland in my first trips there, say in the 1970s, when it had already become a big issue in the United States. And I remember thinking, gee, I'm in Poland, but I don't even hear the church especially talking about abortion issues. That's another question. The church made its own deals with the communist authorities, and it didn't pick on that issue. In any case, with all of these restrictions in 2021, Kaczynski's Supreme Court ruled suddenly. Even that was unconstitutional, and there had to be a complete ban. That brought probably millions into the streets. It was the biggest mobilization since 1989. So there was a great deal of mobilization of opposition to this. During the election, Donald Tusk, who had never spoke about these issues before, said that he was going to pass legislation that would guarantee the right to an abortion until 14 weeks of pregnancy. And many voters supported him on that issue. So that also is one of the issues that the coalition government has not managed to do since it's been in place. Now, it is complicated because they had been talking about it, but one of the coalition partners is a more conservative rural party. If they defected from the coalition, then it would no longer have a majority. And so they said they would not go along with this. And the Tusk government didn't push it. And that was an issue that the left and liberals said.
So they didn't get any compromise whatsoever on this issue. They just didn't do anything.
That's correct. In the end, absolutely nothing is passed, except that their new prosecutor's office and local cities like Trzaskowski, who just lost the presidential election, has been and still is mayor of Warsaw. And so they've kind of promoted these ad hoc liberalizations where we're not going to pursue this, but on legal basis, nothing's been changed. but in an informal way, the prosecution is not prosecuting like in the past, and in Warsaw, it's become more liberal. Now, again, that's good for some people if you have the knowledge about how this thing works, but it's clearly not a solution. So, to sum up your question, has the coalition been totally disappointing? Well, there are two problems. On the one hand, it's true that the president would be obstructing them. Second, it's also true that the coalition has some conservative elements there whose votes are important, and so they have been pushing back against the liberal government. What protesters say, and what has driven a lot of the liberal and liberal left and more radical left, what's provoked their ire at the government, is that Tusk and the government has not pushed the issue. It hasn't passed a lot of bills that they would then force the president to veto. These include bills like for new media law, for reviving an independent judiciary. Under Kaczynski's rule, the judiciary has really been disciplined and even transformed by forcing the nomination of judges who are totally loyal to peace, to that political party, whereas the Constitution says that judges must be nominated by panels of independent judges. And that's one of the things that Kaczynski changed. And so, again, the problems with this coalition is that it didn't pass the bills, forcing the president to veto good things. It couldn't get full agreement among itself. And even if these were big obstacles, as they are, then we did not see Tusk fight for them, right? He can fight for other positions. He can talk about them. He can say, this is unacceptable. We're going to push hard. If he had done that, probably some of these coalition votes that were hesitant on a lot of issues would have gone along. I should also add that it's, you know, there's a lot of discussion about this in America now. Is there too much focus on post-materialist or lifestyle or cultural issues? What about economic issues? But one of the other bills that the coalition ran on was to build housing, provide affordable housing. And so they haven't even produced this bill.
Yeah, no, this is all really interesting. And I was going to ask you in the beginning, what kind of structural and institutional obstacles existed to prevent the liberal coalition from realizing its promises? But I think you've sort of answered it in a way, because it's really a question of a relationship of forces within these coalitions. And, you know, the task for, I guess, the liberal left is to win more people over to the liberal left with fewer objections to some of these policies that you've mentioned that the population would then be disappointed in. It seems like that's what you're saying, right?
Yes. And Tusk himself, look, when he was prime minister, he was roundly criticized by the left because he's traditionally, as his politics tend, center right. In 2023, because there was such antipathy towards the ruling Kaczynski peace coalition, he became clearly moved to the center left. But his record has always been center-right, pro-market, don't rock the boat, don't alienate people, just try to get some things through. Yeah, don't force contentious issues. It's very interesting to look at what has happened to the left in that coalition.
But before we go there, because that is definitely an area I want to get to, I'd like to ask you about the actual campaign, because you've noted this, at least in a, I think it was in a Facebook post, that part of the problem was that the opposition focused very heavily on Nawrocki's character, his ties to like criminal elements, his past as a boxer, his actual status as a, you know, working class guy from a very rough background, rather than on his policies, his far right policies, and that that backfired. So I guess the question then becomes, what does that reveal about liberal campaign strategies and class dynamics in Polish politics? And then maybe at the same time, you could talk about what Nawrocki's platform, especially in relation to Europe, actually was.
Yeah. So in the campaign, we saw, I think, some of the key mistakes that we also saw during Kamala Harris's campaign. And in fact, several Polish articles in the last week since the election have said also that we fell into that kind of trap about talking about the person only. So that really became the focus from the very first day when Nawrocki's candidacy was revealed. The first articles entailed stories about his close contacts with open gangsters who had been to jail, with soccer hooligans who have often been very closely aligned with hardline right-wing politics and with right-wing thugs. He has said that, yes, he knew them and he's friends with them. He said at first, yes, I knew them because I trust and I'm a Christian and I value all people and I tried to help put them on the correct line. There's no evidence of him doing that. But again, these were these character issues. Then in the crucial last weeks of the campaign, because Poland, like France, like other countries, has two votes. One time where all the different candidates run, and then the last 2 weeks where the top two duke it out. And so in those last couple of weeks, the focus was almost entirely on his past, and they weren't focusing on the issues where he talked about signing up again totally for the far right political agenda, getting support from Trump, because while for many reasons in Polish history, including the high numbers of immigrants from Poland to the United States, there's been pro-American feelings in Poland. But that has changed in recent months, particularly as Trump has thrown Zelensky under the bus.
Yeah.
And Poles, for the most part, have been strong defenders of Ukraine. Even the connection with Trump was no longer so popular. Now, it has to be mentioned, though, that on the economic issues, here's where politics doesn't quite match that of the United States. That is, we know in the United States that Trump, in 2016, starting then and up till now, he always talks like he will be a friend of the working class. I will save jobs against corporate raiders, as he talked about in 2016. I don't have to listen to corporations because I'm rich myself, right? He's had a strong anti-elitist rhetoric. But in the United States, Trump has never followed through on any of that. There have been no concrete benefits for workers, for working class people. That is different in Poland. So the Kaczynski government during those years, when it was far right on virtually all issues, including about a democratic form of government, including about cultural policies and all that, it did nevertheless push through some very beneficial gains for workers and non-elites. Most specifically, it gave a very handsome monthly stipend to parents for each child under 18 years old. At first, it was for the first child only, and then after 5 years or so, we'll give the same amount for each child. There's no question that this helped a lot of the poorest families there, and particularly poor single women. All kinds of reports, it brought them out of poverty. It gave them a chance that they could feed their kids and have some bit of a life on their own. Now, of course, leftists often criticize these policies because they say this is neoliberal social welfare. You give directly to an individual, that individual will buy privatized services, so there's nothing social about it. That is true. But it's been happening in a lot of countries lately. We know that the social democratic state-run social welfare model appears to be in crisis everywhere. Also, a lot of people are no longer trusting it as much. So the point is that the Kaczynski government, while not following leftist social policy, nevertheless provided some real concrete benefits to the poor. And for trade unionists and workers, it even took some action to make sure that there were better contracts for workers. Under the liberal government before Kaczynski, I should say Donald Tusk was in power before Kaczynski as well, and now he's come back. So under the liberal government before Kaczynski, Poland was the leader in what was being called junk contracts, in which there were all kinds of ways for employers to skimp on pay, to skimp on social benefits, and to really not give strong contracts to workers. Under peace rule, that changed as well. So I know even leftist trade unionists who still oppose Kaczynski for all kinds of reasons, but shrugging and telling me nevertheless that, yes, the fact is it's been better economically with their policies than with the liberals.
It's really interesting that you say that. As you were beginning to talk, David Oost, I thought, okay, well, this again is modeled on France, which has very, very generous family benefits and stipend or subsidy for each child. And it's something that, if we talk about a parallel here, that it's never been promised by the right. The only thing that the Democrats weekly talk about childcare policy. We don't need to go into the U.S. situation, but the coalition in the United States in the Republican Party, you know, sees this as anathema, except for like the new, more far right populist elements like Pauli and a couple of the others who think, OK, yes, maybe we should promote a family policy. But it seems really interesting to me that in Poland, this was delivered. And of course, there's a history in Poland, too, because I remember very much that this was a strong plank in Solidarność's platform, that there should be, you know, family leave for 3 years, not just for like a couple of months after a baby is born and all the rest of it. So, but I did want to ask you, because you're talking about economic policies versus the character issues that were stressed by the liberals, which seems like a gigantic failure, also repeated here, where they just ran on Trump and Trump's personality and thinking they didn't have to mention anything else, with a sort of condescending attitude to the working class for the most part. But I wonder, because you mentioned the support for Trump until he threw Zelensky under the bus. And we know about, you know, the long history of Polish nationalism and their antipathy to Russia, of course. But I just wonder, for Nawrocki, what were his policies on his platform, if he got a chance to actually talk about them much, on the issue of, say, Ukrainian refugees and, let's say, also climate change and energy policies? And did the Tusk platform have any counter?
Yeah. So on the question of Ukraine is very important, if the legacy of peace and of Tusk's party. When the invasion took place, the full-throated invasion in February 2022, immediately before any policy could be determined, Ukrainians started massively coming to the border and trying to leave and entering Poland. And for the first few days, the government didn't take a position. It seemed a little surprised. And it was really what we could call independent civil society. That is, people, some organizations, you know, people just began showing up at the border, personally helping. Yes, you can come to my house. People old enough to have grown up in during the communist system, who thus knew Russian, often came to the border to help Ukrainians, since most of them, virtually all of them, spoke Russian as well. And so there was this massive effort of support, because Peace and Kaczynski, they weren't anti-Ukrainian, but they were less pro-Ukrainian than the liberals and the most of the left had been as well. But seeing this tremendous wave of public support, then the government joined in, it supported that, and then it did include Ukrainian refugees in the very generous childcare program I mentioned, right? Because many women and children, men couldn't, they still can't leave Ukraine. Women and children came, right? Schools were opened up to them. They got free bus passes, train travel, and were then included in the generous childcare benefits and healthcare. What happened, though, is that there was mostly general support for that in the first months, in the first year. Now, of course, it seems to be about 2.5 years since that started. So in the last year or so, and particularly when the campaign started, then you started to see these differences. So Peace, and particularly Navrotsky, said, of course, we want to do our best to help, but no, we cannot afford this, and we don't want minority communities establishing themselves here forever. And so we're going to restrict the rights to accessing Polish social welfare, restrict those to Ukrainians. There were no specifics because he didn't propose an exact bill on what would be cut or what wouldn't be cut, but he was clearly playing to dissatisfaction, as often happens over time with groups who are not ethnically Polish, or, I mean, we know this happens around the world a lot, right?
Yes.
There might be sympathy at first, and then it turns to, well, you know, don't settle here forever and we need to push back. He also took a position, not like Trump. Again, who knows what Trump's position is? I mean, we know he adores Putin and he said he would stop the war in a day. And now he seems to not care about the war whatsoever. None of those positions have a match in Poland. But nevertheless, there's been some in the Peace right who are not pro-Putin, but who also say, well, this resistance can't last forever. But in recent times, especially as Ukraine and Ukrainian refugees have come over and saying we want help, then that gives a basis for that right-wing nationalist tendency in Poland, which Navrotsky doesn't fully represent them, but he represents them too, right? Navrotsky doesn't declare himself as an outright right-wing fascist, but he has many friends among those who declare themselves right-wing open fascists, and he doesn't push down against that. In that sense, he embraces them even more than Trump embraces the Proud Boys. And so that's why, for that clientele and those issues, they say, well, we have to pursue that issue. And in fact, I just read something today as people are speculating, well, what will President-elect Navrotsky, what will he do? What might be different? What might be different in relation to Ukraine? And they're saying, well, one of the first things he might ask for is an exhumation of bodies in this area that's now currently Ukraine, that used to be Poland, to see, you know, how many Poles were killed in what kind of fashion, and to bring that issue back up. Look,
this is huge, because that also brings up the role of Germany in all of that.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
I just want to throw this out there. Chatham House, in analyzing, that's a, you know, British liberal, sort of liberal institution, said about this election that voters were presented with the stark choice of either a rules-based liberal democracy or a MAGA-esque ethno-nationalist one. Is that how you see it?
Well, that's part of it, clearly. Look, one key issue, besides all these laws and things we have been talking about, is that what Peace does is what Orban has done and what Trump is trying to do now every day. And among the other things that Beast did and that Trump is trying to do is to mine the territory with these authoritarian governing tools that make it impossible for successors to overcome. What do I mean by that? It means that, for example, the judiciary, they changed these laws and they appointed all of these people who were totally subservient to peace in the highest judicial positions. I remember once a woman who was basically like, we could say, Marjorie Taylor Greene in the House, who was a peace watchdog or whatever term we might use, who would make sure to always shout in the most vocal and humiliating terms against the opposition. Peace turned her into a judge on the Supreme Court. And they passed laws that for all independent lawyers was a clear violation of the Constitution. But nevertheless, their constitutional court with people like the Marjorie Taylor Greene said, no, this is constitutional. And their president, the peace president, signed on to all these. So the liberal opposition was saying, all these things are clearly against the Constitution. Moreover, the European Union and the European Union Legal Authority also said that this was against the Polish Constitution and must be reversed. They did not do that. So then when Tusk comes into office, he's dealing with all of these institutions whose very existence is a violation of the Constitution. Wow. Nevertheless, they formally exist. They get paid, they go to their offices. And so what do you do about that? Same thing with public TV. You had the bizarre spectacle that when Tusk won the elections in 2023, for the next few days, the national television is slandering Tusk as a German agent, telling them that everything they've said is a matter of lies. So the government, within a few days, went in and took control of the media and put it back to a more liberal, of course, like good liberals. They didn't go in the opposite way. They became more fair with a tilt towards their side. So in the media and in the courts, the government has tried to marginalize all these institutions. Nevertheless, they legally still exist. And they couldn't get them overthrown because the president kept vetoing those laws as well. This is the kind of thing we're going to face in the United States.
I was just going to say that, David, that in this case, it's not Poland borrowing from MAGA, but showing, I guess, the authoritarian playbook and how it can be done.
Yes, and much of it does come from Hungary. I mean, as Kaczynski, one of his slogans when he came to power in 2015, let's turn Poland into Hungary, something like that. It sounded a little better in Polish.
Yeah, I was going to ask, though, like, what happens now? I think Tusk has called for a vote of no confidence, as you mentioned in your Facebook post, that could lead to new parliamentary elections. Do we know what the possible outcome of that would be? And would peace return to power in a coalition with the, you said, the far right Confederacy Party? Can you explain this for our listeners?
Yes. First of all, you mentioned the Facebook post. It's being published in a online journal called Democracy Seminar. It'll be available on Monday. That's a short account of what's going on now. So yes, after the election, Tusk has called for a vote of confidence, which is supposed to take place, I think, June 11th. He'll probably win it, but we're not 100% sure. Because one of the things that's happened is that for most of the time that peace was in power, it had a policy of like no opposition from the right. We will take, you know, a far right position and we don't want to have opposition from the right. slowly but surely, you did get opposition from the right, some of which were attacking the European Union in stronger terms than peace had done. Also, that further right, they've been attacking Ukraine. They try to take up that issue. Like, they've been pushing that agenda about Ukraine. This is the party called the Confederacy, Confederatia. It's had people, including someone who is a complete and open anti-Semite, of course, having nothing to do with Israel or Gaza, but just to give an example of one of his, a couple of his policies or stunts. So when the Polish parliament last year had, in a nook and cranny of the parliamentary building, had a small celebration of Hanukkah with the Poland's chief rabbi. Of course, there are not many Jews in Poland, but there are some. And they lit a menorah. And so this guy, his name is Grzegorz Braun, comes in with a fire extinguisher, blows out the menorah, and of course, creating all kinds of havoc in the room. Parliament would not completely denounce him. And so he's been someone who's been in the Confederatia. He recently, the Confederatia had this person, then as it tries to win over some moderates, it says, this guy is a little too far to the right. Nevertheless, what was stunning about the first round of elections is that this guy, Brown, actually won 6% of the vote. He came in fourth place after Peace, after Nawrocki. Well, Trzaskowski won the first round. Trzaskowski, Nawrocki, Mentzen, who is the formal head of the Confederacja, who presents himself as a right winger, but, you know, pro small business and again, anti-Ukraine and right wing on social issues. In their campaign, you know, they always talk about taking the red pill. Again, that's a term that the alt-right began using. It's a code word to those people who are strong anti-feminist, or really, you know, it's a kind of hipster fascist term. So, yeah, what happened now is that Confederacja Party has gotten support of more right-wingers who are also tired of Kaczynski and Tusk in office. Look, we can understand that. As we know, Trump is the first president since whenever it was, right, to come back to office. So right. Usually, you know, you're in office and you retire and you're out of politics. Obama is like a senior statesman, even though he's just in his early 60s now. But in Poland, Tusk and Kaczynski have been active on the political scene since the early 1990s, if not Kaczynski a little bit more. So this is before Bill Clinton's in office. And young people see that we've had it's like the same fight, Tusk and Kaczynski, since way before we were born. Wow. So for that reason, some people also say, well, let's go for Mentzen. We just got to shake, get these guys out of our hair, right? And perhaps get these parties out of our hair. We should talk about the left.
Well, that's my next question about bringing it. Let's bring in the Polish left into the picture. What is the role of the left today in Poland? How has it positioned itself within the liberal and let's say nationalist camps? How strong is it? Why have Polish workers, who historically central to resistance movements like Solidarność or Solidarity, tended to move to the right or vote for the right, if they have in recent years? And what does it tell us about class politics and what we all like to call here, or what we hear so much about, realignment, de-alignment, you know, in Poland?
Right. Well, in the first round of elections, there were actually two left candidates who formerly, a little bit before, had belonged to the same New Left Party, the one that's like a Bernie Sanders type party. So that's the party known as Razem, or Together. So what happened is this, is that first in 2015, this new left party called Razem for the first time emerged and ran for office. in the last days, it got about 3 or 4% of the vote, which was spectacular coming from nothing right away. But what it did do is that it meant that that party was under 5%, and the official left party. What happened in 2015 is that none of those parties on the left got into parliament. They were
politics of anti-politics and also the defeat of solidarity. But you can find some of his latest articles, including Workers Often Oppose Democracy and Workers in the Radical Right in Poland and the Surprising Right-Wing Relevance of the Russian Revolution, if you Google him.